A lot of people think stress is just a part of life now. They think being overwhelmed is normal. They think worrying all the time is normal. They think feeling guilty, mentally overloaded, and emotionally exhausted is just what adulthood feels like. But what if a lot of stress is not coming from life itself? What if it's coming from the way we process life, the loops we get stuck in, the habits of mind that we never learned how to interrupt? Now, today's guest is Gary Sprouse, known as the Less Stressed Doc. He is a retired primary physician who has practiced for 38 years and now focuses on helping people reduce stress, worry, guilt, overwhelm through practice tools and a framework that he's developed after years of dealing with intense personal, professional stress himself. This conversation is about stress, why it lingers, why people stay stuck in mental loops, and how to start feeling lighter again. Now, my guest today, Gary Sprouse, is here, and I'd like to welcome you with open hands. And I am just so excited to have you on the show today. And I just want to dive into it because I know that the listeners are just want to hear it. Let's go straight to the real issue. Like, a lot of people are not just stressed occasionally. They live stress. They wake up stressed. They think stressed. They go to bed stressed. What do you think is the real reason why so many people stay stuck in stress?
All right, a couple of things. So first off, you have to figure out how to define stress, right? So because we use that word a lot because we know we just feel bad. But when you define stress, then you go, okay, so let's define stress. So stress is the effort that we have to put in to adapt our changing body with our changing environment, which goes on all the time. So as long as you're alive, there's going to be stress because your body's changing. Like, I'm not the same as I was yesterday. And my environment definitely is different. And so that effort that I have to make to adapt to those things is going to be stress. People talk about good stress or bad stress. And I'm like, no, it's just stress. What makes it good or bad is you. So something could happen. So I tell the story of like a guy who was a farmer and he had an 18-year-old son. And the son breaks his leg. And he's like, oh, this is so bad. What am I going to do? How am I going to take care of the farm? But then the next day, a military recruiter comes and says, hey, we're going to draft your son into the military. He's like, well, he can't go because he broke his leg. He's like, all right, well, then he won't go. So now that same bad stress became a good stress, right? So our perception is what makes it good or bad. It's what you do with the stress that matters. So then the question is, if stress is always going to be there, then we can kind of give up the idea of ever getting rid of stress. I'm just going to be stress-free. No, it doesn't work. You can't be like that. So stop wasting your time and your energy and stop feeling guilty that you're not stress-free. What you need to do, which is way more effective, is to figure out how to be manage your stresses efficiently and effectively. That's the key. But to do that, you have to know where they're coming from. And that's where I see people getting in trouble. They know their boss is a pain in the butt, or commuting is a pain, and traffic, and their wife is this, and their kids are that. But they don't understand what the real underlying problem is. And that's where this book that I wrote, The Highway to Your Happy Place, A Roadmap to Less Stress, comes in, because what it tells you is these are the ingredients that makes things stressful. So when you look at, like, I take this example of someone who's lost their spouse, and I go, hey, you know, that's really sad that you lost your spouse. He's like, I'm grieving. I got this big giant hole. And I go, okay, but what makes losing your spouse so stressful? I can't bring his wife back, but I can do things for the other parts of his stress. So he's feeling worried and he's guilty and regretting and he's feeling a little bored and his self-esteem takes a hit and he's overwhelmed. Like, those I can do something about. And if I can take his hole and make it from this big where he can't function and shrink it to this big, then he can function. And that's the key. But you have to understand where the stresses are coming from. But my insight. So as a doctor, I'm used to writing a prescription that says, hey, here's a blood pressure medicine. It works really good on your blood pressure medicine. Yeah, it might have a few side effects, like it can make you dizzy or make your mouth dry or something like that. But we're going to minimize the side effects and maximize the benefits. But when I took that idea and I applied it to humans and our mind in particular, I was like, wait, what? So what I realized was the majority of our stresses are side effects to our skills. And you're like, what does that mean, right? So I use this example, like, if you have the ability to envision the future, well, then the side effect is you can worry about it. So when psychologists say, well, just live for today, what they're really implying is, well, give up your skill of envisioning the future. I'm like, I don't want to give up my skill. That's a really important skill. Like, that's how I figured out how I could be retired, right? Let's figure out how to raise my kids, blah, blah. So visioning the future is important, but worrying about it, well, now that's a whole different thing, right? So when I had patients that would come to me, like, Dr. Sprouse, I worry that I worry too much. And I'm like, well, then you probably do, right? And I go, so tell me what worry is. And they would look at me like, yeah, I got this. And then they were like, well, what you realize is they knew how it felt. They could use it in a sentence. If they said worry to somebody else, they would know what they meant. But when you tried to define it, it got tricky. And so when you don't have a good definition, well, how are you going to fix that, right? So what I decided was, let's come up with a definition. So here's my definition of worry. Envisioning the future, amazing skill, but then focusing on all the bad things that can happen. And then, and here's the most important part, having a fear reaction right now to those things, right? Now, what happens is you're having a fear reaction to a concept. Like, it hasn't happened yet. You're just reacting to this concept, and there's nothing to make that go away. All you have to do is think about it, and it shows up. And if people go, well, I just won't think about it. I'm like, well, that's awesome. If I say to you, don't think of an elephant, the first thing you do is think of an elephant, right? So you can't not think about stuff. And with our social media, now literally think about this. Like, anybody in the world, any bad thing they can think of is now on a video that gets put on my phone, right? And you're like, wait, what? I hadn't even thought about that. Ah, now I got to think about that too, right? So social media is great. It gives us a lot of information, but it makes us worry a lot because now it says, oh, I hadn't even thought about that. So the more informed you are, the smarter you are, the more things you can worry about and the more trouble you can get into.
It's
So I
so
give people a
true.
couple of tools on how to not worry, which is be realistically optimistic, which means instead of focusing on the bad things, let's focus on good things. But I have to be realistic because I can't ignore that bad things can happen, but I can plan, and key is without fear. So the way to do that is what the second tool, which I call a worry organizer. And so I write this thing out. So I had a lady with breast cancer who was worried about breast cancer. And so it's written down, and you only have to do it once. It takes a little more effort, but now it's already done. So the categories are like, what are you worried about? So this lady was worried about getting breast cancer. So the second category is, why are you worried about that? She goes, well, my mom and my sister both had breast cancer. I was like, oh, okay, well, that would make sense, right? So then the third category is, well, how likely is it to happen? And how bad would it be if it happened? And so when she made out her sheet, what she said was, well, there's a 100% chance I'm going to get breast cancer, and there's a 100% chance I'm going to die from it. And I'm like, whoa, like she's giving herself a death sentence. Right? So I said, well, look, I'm a doctor, and the real statistics are, the more accurate ones are, because you have a family history, your chances are 15%. She's like, wait, that's all? I'm like, yeah. And I go, and because we're going to catch it early, you got an 85% chance of surviving. Well, her whole life changed, right? You could see her body language change right in front of my eyes, right? But then the fourth category is, well, what can I do to make it not happen? So she could stay healthy, she could take vitamins, she could do mammograms, she can do self-exams, she did all these different things, right? And then the last category is, well, what would I do if I got breast cancer? And so we said, well, like, so we started filling out because now we're planning, but without fear. So now we're going, well, I could like research the best breast cancer institutes. I can make sure my will's done. I can make sure that I've made enough money that everybody will survive me. I can make sure my life insurance is paid out. I can, right? All these dust of things. And so now you got a list of to-do things. So then you don't have to have fear. You just have to do the to-do things. And now you got this list, and you can show it to your doctor or to your husband or your friend and go, hey, you got anything else that you could add? You had breast cancer. Is there anything else you could put on there? Right. So now when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning going, ah, you can go, oh, I already filled that in my worry organizer. I'm going to focus on the good things, and then you can go back to sleep.
I love that. I love that. And at what point does stress stop being a reaction and start becoming a pattern?
Well, okay. So I don't know if stress is the pattern, but worry is definitely the pattern. So what we find is this is what I've learned, is that every organism in the world is trying to keep their environment safe. Okay. So humans, the problem we run into is our environment is immense. Like my dog, her environment is what she can smell and see and hear, right? My
Exactly.
environment is the whole globe because I got somebody on the other end sending me a video in China of something bad going on, right? So the
Right.
whole earth is my environment. Oh, but it's worse. The whole universe is my environment because how many movies or books have you read about an alien coming down to take us out, right? So I have to worry about the whole universe. Then, oh, and this is the worst part, now the future. So the future is so real to us that it's literally a part of our environment. So now I have to keep that safe. So I had a did a seminar and I said, okay, think of a time when you felt safe. And one lady raised her hand. She said, I've never felt safe in my life. And I'm like, wait, you've never felt safe? Like, how's that even possible, right? Here's what I learned. What she was saying is, because I don't know what's going to happen in the future, I can't ever feel safe because the future is a part of my environment. And so she was never going to feel safe because we don't know what's going to happen in the future for the most part. We have some ideas, but it's not 100%, right? So what we had to learn, what I had to teach people is what is safety? And then how do you feel safe when you got a 95% chance of success or 90%? And what you see is the more you're willing to tolerate the insecurity of what's going to happen in the future, then the less stress you're going to feel because you're not going to be afraid of those kind of things, right? So the pattern is that worry where you, so here's the example I use. Like if you're sitting in a room and there's 10 people that have $1,000 and they're trying to give it to you, but there's one guy in the corner with a machine gun, like who are you paying attention to, right? The guy in the machine gun. Because if you miss the guy with a machine gun, those $10,000 don't do you any good at all because you're dead, right? So we have it, it's built into us to pay attention to the bad things, but we have the ability to choose. So I can say, well, my brain is telling me to pay attention to the bad things, but I can choose. So I'm going to pay attention to the good things, but I'm not going to ignore that bad things can happen, right?
Now, one thing that makes stress so frustrating is that it becomes circular. Like people worry and then they stress about worry and they feel guilty, then they feel worse about the guilt. They get overwhelmed, they freeze, and then they feel bad that they froze. You talk about stress reducer loop model. Now, without getting too technical, like what loop are people getting trapped in and how do they start like breaking it?
So it's not, the loop model is actually not very technical at all. It's actually pretty straightforward. What it says is people have stress. We all have stress, right? As long as we're alive, we're going to have stress. But then everybody finds some way to reduce their stress. So I just met a lady the other day who's she reads books to reduce her stress, or somebody watches TV, or they exercise, or they take heroin, or they drink alcohol. They find ways to reduce their stress. And but then here's where the problem starts. When the stress reducer that you picked starts causing stress, now you're in a loop. So now you have stress, you do your loops, your stress reducer loop, you do your stress reducer, which then causes stress, which then makes you do your stress reducer. So I use this example, like this guy goes to work and he had a bad day at work. So he stops off at the bar to get a couple beers and he feels better. That's a stress reducer. I had a couple beers, I feel good, right? But then he's driving home and he gets a DUI. So now a stress reducer just caused stress. So then he goes home to his wife and goes, honey, you won't believe this. I had a bad day at work and then I got a DUI. Yikes. And the wife's like, oh my God, I can't believe you did that. He goes, yeah, I'm going to go get a beer. She's like, what? What do you mean you're going to get a beer? So now his wife's yelling at him, right? Because now he's going to go get a beer because that's a stress reducer, right? So that's the loop.
I
So the
see.
difference between that and calling an addiction and a disease is like, first off, everybody is at risk for getting into stress reducer loop. If I give somebody enough stress, they're going to get into trouble because they're going to need to use their stress reducer more and find something that's stronger, which is going to be way more likely to get them in trouble.
I
And
get
second
it.
off, anything we pick to be a stress reducer can end up being in a loop, right? So this lady I was talking to, when she was a high school kid, and she started reading all the time. To the point where her mom was complaining because she wasn't out playing with her friends. She was staying awake all night reading these books so that she was half asleep during the day, right? So it was turning into a loop. And then she said the way she got out of it was she figured out, hey, I got other ways to reduce my stress, so I don't need to read. And I got other things I can figure out how to have less stress. That's the answer, right? So the answer is how to have less stress, which then is where my book comes in, Highway to Your Happy Place, Roadmap to Less Stress. And then finding other ways to reduce your stress, that don't cause problems.
Right.
So it's someone said to me, well, you're trying to make it easy. I'm like, I'm not, it's not easy,
Yeah.
but it's more straightforward because when you know what it is you're trying to do, that you're going to be way more likely to be successful.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Now, like, what's the first sign that someone is caught in the loop instead of just having a rough day?
It's tricky, right?
Yeah.
Because it's very individualized. So here's the example. Like if somebody, like say some lady got married to this guy because he doesn't drink alcohol, right? And then he starts his own business and he's struggling because there's payroll problems and all these different issues. So kids come and he has a drink at night. And he's just having one drink. It's not affecting his work, it's not affecting his liver, right?
Yeah.
But his wife's like, no. And he's like, what do you mean, no? He goes, no, this is the way my dad started. He started with one drink because he had a bad day at work, and then it became two drinks, and then it became a bottle, and then he ended up dying of liver failure. I'm not doing that. I married you because you don't drink. And so
Yeah.
he's like, so he's in a loop, but even though he's only drinking one drink, right?
Yeah.
So I met this guy, and here's the difference. So I met a guy at a nursing home that I took care of.
Yeah.
His doctor came in and said, Bill, you're an alcoholic. And Bill's like, what are you talking about? Where did you get that from? He goes, I'm like 60 years old. I'm a therapist. What are you talking about? He goes, well, it says on your ER sheet that you had pneumonia and that you drink four drinks a night. So that makes you an alcoholic. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't get DUIs. I don't drink and drive. My wife doesn't, I work every day. What are you
Yeah.
talking about? He goes, well, four drinks a night is in the top 10% of alcohol consumption in our country. And you're an alcoholic. Because you do this every night. And he's like, no. And he goes, and the doctor goes, yeah, you have the disease and you're just in denial. So what did the guy do? He fired him because I don't want to deal with you. Like,
Yeah.
what? So I came in and here's what I said to him. I was like, well, okay, you're right. You're not having any problems from the alcohol presently.
Right.
Okay. But do you really need, as your treatment for stress, do you need four drinks? What
Right.
if you just did two? What if you just did one? And the
Yeah.
guy started thinking, I go, because your liver is okay right now, but you're 60 years old. And the chances of it being okay, 5 years from now, maybe not so good. Maybe your
Right.
brain's going to deteriorate from the alcohol. Maybe your heart's going to deteriorate. It's like, so I'm like, as we were talking, as it's a treatment, maybe we can use less of the treatment. And
Right.
so he was like, he was willing to engage because now nobody's telling me he's the disease dumbhead, right? They're going,
Yeah.
oh, you have this problem that you're treating. And it's not causing problems right now, but it might. So then he left thinking, oh, okay, I'm just going to drink one drink because that's probably going to be enough to let me relax at night, right?
Yeah.
So that's the difference in how you approach the patient and the problem.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Now, I want to hit like three things that people deal with constantly: worry, guilt, and regret. Now, let's start with worry. Like, what can people do when they worry too much and they know it, but they still can't stop, seem to stop? And I can name a dozen people in my family like this.
Well, okay. So we talked about the tools that I use, which is understand what worry is, number one, and then
Right.
using realistic optimism and a worry organizer. But here's what I found, because I thought this is super, because way too many people worry too much. I'm like,
Yeah.
so everybody's going to flock to me and look for. No, they don't. And here's why, because many people think that worry shows that you care.
Yeah.
So they equate worry with care. So when you don't worry, then they go, oh, don't you care? And so what I found was people don't want to change the worry because they think that shows they care. And what I have to explain to them is when you worry, what that really means is that you're having a fear reaction.
Yeah.
And fear turns off the thinking part of your brain.
Yes.
So now you can't think as well because you're running around in fear.
Yes.
So when I, so, and I had the struggle with my wife. I go, she's like, we got this problem. I go, okay. And I'm sitting there calmly going, okay, what are we going to do? We can do this, we can do that. She goes, why aren't you worried? I'm like, because that's not helping. Well, what do you mean? Don't you care? And I'm like, well, yes, I care a lot. So that's
Yeah.
why I'm not worried. And that's why I'm not having a fear reaction, because now that allows me to think better. So now, because what we really want to do is solve the problem, not worry about it. But you have
Exactly.
to get out of your head that worry shows you care. And get in that where it actually interferes with you trying to fix the problem that you're worried about.
Right. It's so
Once you can
true.
do that, then you can start using those tools to say, okay, now, and what I say, I just say to these people, I go, I don't want you to stop worrying. What I do want you to stop is worrying inefficiently. Because when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, your head's going, rrr, that doesn't help anything at all. That's not helping. So what I say is worry, plan for the future, but without the fear. And then you get the benefit of your envisioning a future without all this fear and all this bad outcome stuff going on, because now you've worked it out, right? That's number one. So the other one you talked about was guilt. And somewhere along the line, we need to talk about overwhelm, because all this leads up to being overwhelmed, right? But guilt is very different than regret, which I didn't realize when I started this book. So I'm writing Highway to Your Happy Place, Roadmap to Less Stress, and I'm going, oh, guilt and regret. And I'm like, wait, those aren't the same thing. So guilt is I broke a rule. I did something wrong. Regret is I made a bad choice. Very different, right? Now they have some similarities. So they both are describing things that happened in the past. So I did something, I made a choice. So they're in the past and you can't change them. Okay. So guilt, so now here's the idea. So guilt is society's tool to shape our behavior. Because we want people acting a certain way because we live in a group, right? So when someone says, like, hey, you committed murder, and they go to trial and they're sitting in the courtroom and they're bawling their eyes out and they're like, oh, I can't believe I did that. And we go, oh, yeah, you understand that you broke a rule and you're remorseful and you're never going to do that again. Okay, fine. But if somebody comes in the courtroom, like, yeah, whatever, I killed the guy, I don't give a crap. Wait. We don't like that at all because you don't feel guilty. We're not able to shape your behavior. That's not good. We don't like that, right? So guilt is meant to shape your behavior. So say you were an alcoholic and you did some bad things as an alcoholic and you feel guilty and you're like, okay, so change. So the change then is you can't change what happened, but you can change what's gonna happen. So now stop drinking, be sober. And then guilt did what it was supposed to do. It changed your behavior. So now you don't need to feel the guilt as much because it did what it was supposed to do. You changed behavior. Now, if you go back to drinking, okay, now go back to feeling guilty. So then regret is totally different. So regret is our skill of being able to make a choice, which is on nobody, no other organism has this skill, right? So we're the only organism that has these skills. So we can say, I want chocolate. No, I want vanilla, right? Or I want to eat that cake, but I'm not because I want to lose weight. We have choices, okay? So then when someone regrets their choice, they go, I made a choice and it didn't work out. I'm not liking that. And they beat themselves up with regret. And I see this with mothers all the time. They go, I wish I had spent more time with my kids and less time at work, right? And so they have this large regret. And I'm like, wait, let's step back a second. Okay. So, what I say is when you're making a choice, your choice is always about the future. So, you're always looking ahead, going, okay, how much time should I spend with my kids versus how much time should I spend at work? So, you don't know the answer. There's no, like, and here's what I say to people, there's an informational void. There's not enough information because you never have enough of the information in the present. You certainly don't have enough what's going on in the future, right? So you're always making these decisions with an information lack. So when a decision doesn't work out the way you want it to, you can feel some regret, but then you go, wait. So here, I'll give you this example. So I was running my office and my office manager came and said, Doc, your computer system's old and we need to get a new one. You're like, all right, that makes sense. And they're like, so I want you to take this one because I've worked with this before and it's great. And I'm like, well, that's awesome, but nobody else in the office knows how to use this. So I'm like, okay. And I said, you're going to be here, right? She goes, yeah. She goes, I've turned down jobs that would pay me more because I like working here. And you're like, all right. So I sign on the dotted line, I buy the computer. It hasn't even come yet. And she comes back to me. She says, oh, somebody offered me $20 an hour more, so I'm leaving. And I'm like, wait, what? So now I could regret the decision and go, what a dumb head I was for signing on the dotted line, knowing that this is it. But when I went back and I go, wait, with the information that I had at the time, I made a good decision. So I can't regret the decision because it was a good decision. What changed was the circumstances changed, which then made it look like a bad decision. Now, what I can do is the next time I end up in that situation, going, okay, we're not picking a computer system that nobody else knows anything about, or we're going to pay somebody to teach us how to do it, so we're all going to learn at the same time, or
Yeah.
whatever, so I can tweak the process that I use to make the decision. I could say, I could say, I'm going to make her sign in blood the next time, right? But whatever. But I didn't have to regret the decision because it was made with the information I had. It was a good decision. Now, what
Right.
I do see is sometimes people will go back up the decision tree
Yeah.
and get themselves in trouble. So they'll go, hey, I went to the store to buy some milk, and there was only one line at the store, and it was really long. I'm like, ugh, I'm really upset that I came to this store. I should have gone to the other store that has three lines. But then they can go back and go, well, there's only one line, so that's what I had to do. Then go, but why did I have to come on a Friday night when it's busy, right? I
Yeah.
should have bought milk some other time. Or they go, why do I even have to buy milk? If I didn't have kids, I wouldn't have to buy milk. Why did I get married? Then I wouldn't even have kids, right? So it's like you can go back up the decision tree till you
Yeah.
can find something that you regret. Don't do that, right?
Yeah.
Unless you want to start tweaking your decision-making process so that you can then make either get more information or get better at figuring out who to talk to or
Right.
figuring out something in your process that will give you a better outcome.
Right. Oh, I love that. That is amazing information. A lot of people listening are not just stressed, they are overwhelmed, like you just mentioned earlier. And when people get overwhelmed, they often shut down, they procrastinate, or they just mentally spin in their heads. So you talked about the shoe boxes as a way to help people feeling, so they could stop feeling that overwhelm. What is the biggest idea there?
Okay, so let's first off think about overwhelmed. So I'm a doctor, right? So I've been trained how to recognize people and put symptoms together and then give it a label and then treat the label, right? So people come in and they go, hey, I can't eat, I can't sleep, I can't think very well. And I go, oh, those fit into the box of depression. So you must have depression. So I'm going to give you an antidepressant medicine. And then they come back 2 weeks later and I go, well, I feel a little bit better. And you're like, great, so let's increase the dose or whatever, right? But here's what I found, that probably 80% of people that are diagnosed with depression really are overwhelmed. And really what's gone on is they just have too many problems on their plate. So what happens to that person that's taking the medicine, 6 months later, they come back on, dude, I'm still feeling bad. And so now if you listen to the commercials, well, we need to give you a second drug, or we need to give you, right? We need to give you something else. And you're like, yeah, no, wait. So what I so I had a patient come to me who was like 80, and his kids brought him because they thought he was depressed. I go, so what's going on? He goes, I'm so upset, I'm pissed off. He goes, my knee doesn't work, so I can't walk around like I used to. I can't get on the roof and clean out the leaves in my gutter. And my wife's getting dementia, and she doesn't remember crap. And I'm like, oh, this is so frustrating. Blah, 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 blah. And I go, and I can't sleep right, and I'm not eating well, and a regular doctor would have said, oh, you're depressed. Here's a medicine, right? Here's what I said to him. I said, dude, you're overwhelmed. And he goes, what? And I go, look, your wife is deteriorating. She's losing her humanity because she's becoming dementia. You're suffering with grief because you can't do all the things you used to do. And what goes along with that is then you're losing your independence, right? Plus, you got to take these medicines that are hurting your appetite and you're not sleeping well because all. I'm like, let's work on some of these problems and get rid of some of these problems or change your attitude toward these problems, and then you won't feel so bad. And he looked at me, he goes, that's so much nicer to hear because now you're gone, you don't have a brain damage. You're not medic, you're not chemically imbalanced where I got to take some chemical that will balance me for the rest of my life. No, I just got too much crap going on, and let's figure out a way to get rid of it. So one of the ways to get rid of it, there's two things that I talk about, an empathy wall and the shoebox. So I'll go to the shoebox first. So here's the, so what I find is I don't know why people do this, but they do lumping. So you've probably done this. I know I've done this. You're like, you wake up and you're like, oh, I gotta go to work. Then you go, oh, my car's not working right. And then my kid called me, was giving me a hard time. And then this happened. And then you, oh yeah, and I forgot that I put here. Like you just keep looking for things to crawl up on top, right? So now you end up overwhelmed because you're like, oh my God, what am I gonna do with all this crap, right? So what, here's the answer. So I teach people how to de-lump. Okay. So the first step is recognize that you're lumping, number one. But then number two is de-lump. And the technical term is compartmentalization. Okay. So by de-lumping, what you find is no one of those stresses is overwhelming. It's only when you let them all get together that they cause the problem, right? So to de-lump, I put this picture in your head of a shoebox. So if you walk into your bedroom and there's 100 shoeboxes, and the bottom's here, and the lid's over there, and the right shoe's here, and the left shoe's there, and there's 100, you're like, oh, this is crazy, right? That's insane. But if you walk into the same room, and now the bottom's here, the tifs and the right are inside, the lid's on top, they're stacked up nicely in the closet. That's a lot of shoe boxes, but it's not overwhelming. Now you just take that one shoe box, you look at it, you put it back up, you take the next one down, you look at it, put it back up. So my wife said to me, well, honey, that's not going to work because some of these stresses are linked. And you're like, okay, I'll give you that some of these are put together. So maybe you can't have, maybe two of them are kind of linked. You have to take two at a time. But the more compartmentalized you are, the less you're lumping, then the less overwhelmed you're going to be. So that's what I talk about. So the second tool I use is called the empathy wall. And there's two bricks of that wall that are really important. So as a resident, as a doctor, I had to learn that I had to have this wall that was around me. And it had to be thick enough that when people came and had these disastrous things happen to them in their life, that I didn't fall apart. Because if I'm falling apart, how am I going to help you, right? The second thing was, but it had to be thin enough that I could still be empathetic and care about what happened to you, right? So the two stones that I put in there is one, I can't fix you. The best that I can do is give you really good advice and get really good at persuading you to use it. That's my, right? That's what I can do. But you have to take the medicine, or you have to take the operation, or you have to do the test. I can't make you do those things. So my metric of success is not, do you do these things? It's, am I giving you good advice? And am I getting really good at giving it to you so you can use it, right? Well, I can get better at that. I can read more. I can read books on persuasion, right? So I can get better at helping you help get you better, but I can't fix you. When I take that off the table and my metric of success is giving you good advice, well, that makes my life a whole lot easier. Then the second one is that everybody else's, my stresses max out at a 10 to me, but everybody else's stresses max out at a 5. Now, that doesn't mean they're zero. I still care, but they're a 5. So I said this to a mother. And what she realized was she goes, I'm taking on my son's stresses as a 10. So I'm pulling my hair out. I'm not sleeping. I'm not eating because he's not blah, 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 right? She goes, you know what? You're right. She goes, when I decided that his stresses were a 5 to me, that meant I could still help him, but they're only a 5. They max out at 5, right? So she's like, oh my God, I got all this energy back. I go, yeah. Because you're not worth wasted on trying to fix him, right? So when you have that empathy wall, then you're way less likely to get stressed out. Because here's, I use this thing called a sponge, right? And I see this more with women than men, right? Because they're used to taking in everybody else's stresses. Women like to share their stresses, and that helps relieve their stress. Well, you think of yourself as a sponge. So you got this friend telling you stuff, and this friend, and your neighbor, and your son, and your grandfather, and blah. And all of a sudden, your stress, your sponge is getting saturated. And then you start leaking. And you're like, oh my God, I'm leaking. Oh, right. And then somebody goes, oh, but Bill, can you tell me about? And you're like, no, like I'm already oversaturated. I'm already leaking, right? So it's like, yeah. So what you have to do then is when you treat everybody else's stresses as a 5, well, then you don't leak. Because then you're like, okay, I'm here to help you. I know I can't fix you, so I'm going to give you the best advice I can, but it's on you to do something with it. So now my sponge is, I can take in more. As a doc, I was a young whip. My patients go, you're a young whippersnapper doctor. I'm like, yeah, that's me. So I'm like, I'm going to fix everybody. I'm going to be great. Literally, by the end of the first day, I was overwhelmed. I'm like, I'm not going to fix, I learned real quickly, I'm not going to fix anybody, and I gotta have this wall that I can be empathetic but not overwhelmed with everybody that comes in. Because as a doctor, literally everybody's coming into you with a problem, right?
Oh,
So
for sure.
right. So once I figured out the shoe boxes and the empathy wall, then I was able to be a really good doctor. Like I've had friends of mine that still think they're gonna fix people. So when the person comes back with the same problem and they're not fixed, they beat themselves up. And I'm like, stop that. You can't fix them. Like, if they're not going to do what you say, that's not on you. That's on them. Like, your job is to give them the best advice and help them use it so they can be better. But it's up to them to do it, right?
Oh yeah. I've known doctors that have left the practice because of that. The patient kept coming back with the same problem, or they weren't getting better, or they got better and then they came back with the same problem again, and they just lost hope in the medical field
So you
because of
use the
that.
word hope. And so in my practice, I took care of a lot of patients that were in chronic pain. And by the time they got to me, they'd already had three surgeries. I had one guy who had 20 surgeries on his back by the time he was 50. Okay.
Wow.
So they've already done physical therapy and they've done, tens units and braces and blah, blah, blah. So they're coming to me. I'm the last resort, right?
Yeah.
And here's what I would say to them. Like, we're going to do everything we can to figure out where your pain is coming from and try to get rid of what's causing the pain.
Yeah.
But if we can't get rid of the pain, then we're going to do everything we can to minimize the pain to the point where you can function.
Exactly.
And what that gave people was hope.
Yeah.
Because when the chronic pain patient came to me and decided never, it's never going to go away, it's never going to get better, that's when they would get into trouble. So
Yeah.
my job was to really give them hope, going, hey, look, you know what? Like, the medicines we have for you are okay.
Yeah.
Like, I'm giving you Percocet, right?
Yeah.
But it's not that great. Like,
No.
if I draw your blood and I stick a needle in your arm, you're like, ow, that really hurt. Like, you're on Percocet. Why should that hurt? Are you kidding me? How's that going to help when bones are rubbing on each other? Of course it's going to hurt, right?
Yeah.
We go, but look, you know how many changes have happened in the world of medicine in the last 10 years? Never mind the last 40 years. What do you
Yeah.
think is going to happen in the next 10 years, or the next 20 years? We're going to find better medicines for pain control. We're going to find better techniques. We're going to find better things. And that's the hope that you need to have so that you keep doing day to day, getting up with that pain in your back that that's keeping you from doing stuff. And so
Yeah.
my job was to give them hope.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Now, what is one small thing someone can do today if they feel like everything is too much?
Well, it's not a small thing, it's a big thing. Here's what I tell people. A lot of patients would come to me and go, Dr. Sprouse, I know where I don't want to be,
Yeah.
but I don't know where I do want to be. And I'm like, well, that's a problem.
Yeah, that is a
So
problem.
that's when I started working on the happy place idea, because when I wrote my book, Highway to Your Happy Place, Roadmap to Less Stress, I wrote the second half first. I'm writing how to have less stress. But I
Yeah.
realized from talking to patients, oh, we need to have a place to go. So my mantra now is, hey, let's figure out where your happy place is, and then let's get rid of the stresses that are keeping you from there.
Yes.
So when I say to people, tell me what your happy place is, they go, oh, I love the beach. And I go, well, that's great. How often do you get to go to the beach? And they go, I don't know, a couple of times. Well, okay, you're from New Jersey, so it's the shore, okay? I go, how often do you get to go? And they go, oh, a couple of weeks a year. I'm like, really? So that means 50 weeks out of the year, you're not in your happy place. Really? Let's find a better happy place that you can have with you every time. It's in your pocket. You can pull that when you want.
Yeah.
So here's what I realized, that everybody's happy place is different,
Yes.
but they all have the same rooms. So their rooms are the same. They're just decorated differently. So some people
True.
use red paint. Some people use blue paint. Some people use pink. Some people put posters. Some people put pictures, right? They're
Yeah.
decorated differently, but they're all the same rooms. So what are the
Right.
rooms, right? So the rooms are things like gratitude. And I don't think we're grateful. I know I'm not. I just had this realization the other day. Like, I'm a doctor, right? So I'm used to writing antibiotics. But
Yes.
it wasn't that long ago before we didn't have antibiotics. If you go
Right.
back to the 1800s, we didn't have antibiotics,
Nope.
right? So if you take that idea and you're like, wait, so I'm looking back at my life going, well, I had appendicitis. Well, I would have died because they gave me antibiotics to fix that.
Yeah.
Then 20 years later, I had pneumonia. Well, I would have died then, except somebody gave me antibiotics.
Yeah.
Then literally 2 months ago, I had a diverticulitis. And again, literally 2 days later, I'm better because I took some pills, right?
Right.
We didn't have those 100 years ago, 100 years
Nope.
ago. So I need to be grateful that I'm still alive because of antibiotics. Yay, right? So, and because we have this tendency to complain about what we got going on right now, but we
Yeah.
forget about all the stuff we have. So my wife and I were traveling to Germany, and we were in this beautiful castle. It was like, it's huge. It had 100,000 rooms and bedrooms and ornate decorations. You're like, this is amazing, right? But then I'm like, wait, he didn't have air conditioning. He didn't have heating. He didn't have a cell phone. He didn't have an elevator. He didn't, wait, what? He didn't have indoor toilets. What? Yeah. Like, I'm living better than the King of Germany was 300 years ago. Like, are you kidding me? But we have to be grateful. So then the next things are like pleasure. and we have to have pleasure in our life. And we
Yes.
tend to wait for the big pleasures. You have a baby or you graduate or whatever. No, there's literally every day there's a thousand little pleasures if you pay attention.
100%.
Then there's things like feeling anticipating pleasure. Like, so I'm
Yeah.
getting ready to go on a trip to Italy. So in my anticipation, I can just go, oh, ooh, when we go to Italy, it's going to be awesome. And in
Yeah.
my anticipation, our bag is going to show up. My wife and I are going to still talk to each other at the end of the trip, right? It's good stuff, right? But then there's a thing called where we feel fulfilled. And fulfilled comes from three things. We're learning because we're a curious organism.
Right.
Sharing and giving because we're a communal organism,
Yes.
and we have a purpose in life.
Yes.
And so that's a struggle for people because it used to, for every other organism, their purpose in life is to stay alive. But for humans, it's so easy. It can't be a purpose anymore. So now we have to come up with something else. So my purpose has been to help people get healthier and happier, right?
Yes.
The wife struggled because she was doing the billing from my office and she hated it.
Yeah.
But when we retired, I'm like, oh, she's going to be so happy. She woke up the first morning, she didn't have to do billing. And she looked at me like, what am I supposed to do with myself? I'm like, oh, because she didn't have a purpose.
Right.
So it's taken her a year, but now she's like, she does honeybees. She's got a garden. She volunteers at a place. She's got a church that she goes to, and there's women groups that she gets involved. So now her life's getting fulfilled. Now she has a purpose, right? So
Yeah.
it's good. So she's way better than she was that first day she woke up, right? And then there's a whole nother room, set of rooms called cash. And it's not money because money doesn't buy us happiness.
No,
Okay.
does
So
not.
the cash is an acronym and it stands for feeling controlled because we
Yep.
all want to feel controlled in our life and
Yeah.
feeling connected. And it stands for appreciation because it turns out appreciation was the original currency. Before we had money, we appreciated each other. Like, oh, thanks for getting
Yes.
me those extra berries. Hey, I'm going to give you a fish. Oh, thanks for giving me, right? Appreciate. And we're still there.
Yeah.
And it's free. Doesn't cost anything. All you got to do
Yes.
is say, be genuine, and go, thank you so much. So I've learned with my wife, she loves to cook. It's like,
Yeah.
I make sure I appreciate her cooking. Honey, thank you so much for making dinner. That was awesome. Every night, because
Right.
that appreciation is like gold.
It
Okay.
is. Oh,
And
for
then there's
sure.
things like feeling safe and having spirituality, right? And as a scientist, spirituality is a little tricky for me because it's like, wait, that's not provable. What the heck, right? But here's what
Yeah.
I realized in our brain, there's four parts to our brain. There's a thinking part, emotional part, a daredevil part, and a part that we feel connected to the universe.
Yes.
And that part gets drowned out a lot. So religion and spirituality brings that part out.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, like meditation, hypnosis, psilocybin, it brings that part of our brain out where we
Yeah.
go, whoa, I'm connected with the universe. This is so freaking cool.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, so that's where our spirituality lies. And the last two are hope and humor. So we like humor because it reduces the badness of things.
Yes.
When we can laugh about it, then we don't have to cry, right? And
Yes.
hope is critical. And we've talked about hope already, but there was a guy, Viktor Frankl, who wrote a book on the Holocaust. And he got through the Holocaust with the hope that he was going to get out and write a book and help people.
Right.
His friend had the hope that the Allies were going to come and free him on March 1st. And so when March 1st came and the Allies didn't, he lost hope. And 3 days later, he was dead. And you're like, that's how much hope matters.
Yes.
So when you put all those rooms together, what a great place. And it's in your pocket. You could, so you're yelling at your kids going, oh, but I'm really grateful that I have kids and I hope that they're going to be better, right? You can pull it out right then when you're really upset. My
Right.
boss sucks. Well, it's like, oh, yeah, but I have a job and I can pay my bills. Oh, that's awesome, right? And it's
Yep.
fulfilling because it gives me something to do, even if I don't like it, right? Right. So it's really nice. So now you have this happy place that you know where it is. Now you know how to manage your stresses more effectively because you know that they're just side effects to your skills. And I'm going to keep my side skills and get rid of the side effects. And now
Yes.
I'm going to live in my happy place all the time.
I love it. I love it. Now, a lot of people want to be more positive, but fake positivity doesn't work. Now, you talk about realistic optimism, which I think is much better. So, what is a realistic optimism for people who don't know what that means?
Okay, I'll give you my example, right? So when I was writing my book, I'm sitting there going, oh, I'm a doctor, I'm busy, I'm never going to get this book done. Even if I get it done, who's going to buy it? Even if they buy it, it's not going to help anybody because who am I, right? That's focusing on the negative things that could happen, which
Right.
then makes me feel bad right now, which guess what? Then I don't finish the book.
Yeah.
So what I did was I like, no, I'm going to be optimistic. I'm going to get this book's going to get done. It's going to be great. It's going to help a whole bunch of people. I'm going to be in the Oprah show. Nah, she retired. All right, I'll be on the Ellen show, right? But I'm optimistic. But and here's the key, I didn't say, okay, well, I'm going to be the best author ever, and I'm just
Yeah.
going to quit my job as a doctor because I'm going to be a number one bestseller. No, what I learned was the realism part of that was the average author sells 250 books in his lifetime, and you're like, well, you can't live on selling 250 books, right? So I realized that the realism part was I had to keep being a doctor to pay my bills until I could retire, and then
Right.
I could shift. Then I could say, okay, I'm not going to be a doctor, and I'm just going to focus on this part.
Yeah.
That realism is critical because you're right. There's this, I don't even know what this term, I've heard this term, toxic positivity. And I'm like,
Yeah.
what the heck is that, right? Well, what it is that unfettered optimism where you're ignoring that bad things could happen. That's what
Yeah.
people are in trouble.
That's
Does
so
that
true.
explain it better?
Oh yeah, 100%. So why do people swing between negativity and fake positivity instead of just landing on something that's more realistic?
Well, some of it is because of our perceptions, right? So we get these. So there's a thing that I talk about called the perspective prism. And in that prism is our experiences and our facts and our theories and our emotions and all that kind of, they're in this, right? So when information comes in, it filters through that.
Yeah.
And then it comes out as a perception on the other side. So when people say your perception is your reality, that is true.
Right.
But then your perceptions then drive your emotions and your actions. So I use my example. So if I'm sitting in the room talking to a patient and my nurse walks in with a big giant needle. So the patient and I both see the same thing, but our perspective prisms are real different, right?
Yeah.
The patient's like, oh, I know what needles feel like. I don't like that at all. So their perception is, oh, that needle's meant for me and that's going to hurt. So my emotions are fear and they're pulling back.
Yeah.
My perceptive prism is like, that's not, you weren't supposed to be in this room. You're in the wrong room. So my
Yeah.
perception is my stupid nurse got into the wrong room and now she's scaring the crap out of my patient. And so my emotion is anger. And I'm like, get the hell out of here, right? So
Right.
we saw the same thing, but our perceptions were totally different. And what I find in that perspective prism, that is the key. I
Yeah.
can't change your perception. What I can change is what you thought about inside there, what led you to that.
Right.
So when someone says, I don't have any friends. Well, I can't say, yeah, you do. You have friends. Come on, admit it. You have friends. You're like, well, that's never going to work. What I
Yeah.
can say is, what makes you think you don't have friends? What's your definition of a friend? Then you go, oh, now I understand. I go, well, you talk to your sister every day. She goes, well, that's not a friend. That's my sister. I'm like, wait. I'm like, well, you go play cards with him every week. Well, but they're just acquaintances. They're not friends. So now, I can't argue with her. She has no friends. What I can talk about is let's change your definition of what a friend is.
Yeah.
So then you can have friends, right?
Exactly.
That's the key. So what you're seeing is then people think of themselves with that perspective prism. What's in
Yeah.
there will determine what they think about something. That's when we talked about earlier, the good and bad stress. What's in that prism will determine what's going to, your self-esteem is in that prism. And what
Right.
I see is self-esteem gets started when you're an infant. When you
Yeah.
start figuring out you're different than your parents, your self-esteem starts accumulating. So by five, it's pretty set up.
Yeah.
But you don't even know what happened between one and five. Like, you don't
Yeah.
even know. So your
Right.
self-esteem has been set up and you didn't even know how it got there. But
Yeah.
it tends to be an identity. So you tend to keep it and you massage the information that's coming in to fit with what's in your prism.
Yeah.
Like, what happens is when you have low self-esteem, you tend to ignore the good things and blast the big thing, the bad things. So you tend to keep that self-fulfilling prophecy of the, yeah, I suck, right? And so it's hard to change unless you can get into that prism and go,
Yeah.
well, the way you're keeping track is not accurate. So
Exactly. Now, how does a realistic optimism reduce stress without becoming like naive?
would that become a what?
Becoming naive. Like you
Oh,
can change
naive.
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's so the key is that's where the realistic optimism part. So you can be optimistic, but you can't be in denial. This is
Right.
where I see husbands get into trouble. They're like, honey, that's not going to happen. Like, it can't happen. And you're like,
Right.
yeah. And she's like, yeah, it can. Like a plane crashing, right? She's like,
Yeah.
the plane's not going to crash. I used to stop worrying about it. And she's like, there was just a plane that crashed last week and
Exactly.
350 people died. Like, no, planes can crash. So you can't ignore that bad things can happen, but you can focus on good things, like the plane's going to land. Here's what I would love to see, right? Our newspaper article will come out and say, a plane crashed and 360 people died. And it's in big bold letters, right?
Yeah.
But right next to it, just in biggest bold letters, is 100,000 planes landed safely yesterday. So now you
Exactly.
get to see both right next to each other. Because what happens to us is we want to see good things, but we have to pay attention to bad things. So when we see that banner that says a plane crashed, 360 people die, that
Yeah.
sets off the stress inside of us, like, oh my God, what if I was on that plane? Ah, right. But there's no balance.
No
That's where our
balance.
media's gotten into trouble. There's no balance. So
This
if
is
you
good
had,
said.
hey, a plane crashed, which gives us the information, but 100,000 planes landed safely. Oh, now we go, oh, okay. Well, I'm probably on, my chances are that 100,000 is way more likely I'm going to be on that one, right?
Right. That's why I stopped listening to the media. Like it was like, 'cause all they show is the negative things. They never do the balance, So to
Wow.
watch that,
Okay.
you can get so
So I watch
depressed.
CBS News, right? And in the beginning, they give you all the negative crap that's going on. But at the end, there's always a 5-minute segment on, hey, here's a funny thing, or here's a happy thing, or here's a good story.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, right? So 25 minutes are on bad, 5 minutes are on good. And we tend to ignore the good. We
Yeah.
go, oh, this just talks about bad stuff. I'm like, no, they give you 5 minutes of good. Like, you just got to pay attention to it because we don't.
We
Like,
don't.
it's built into us to pay. That's what I was talking about with the machine gun guy.
Yeah.
Like, we want to see the $1,000 in people's hands, but we have to pay attention to the guy with the machine gun. And
Right.
that's where we get into trouble. And that's built into our brain. So that's just the way it is. What we've learned is there's a whole bunch of machine guns out there that are here in the present, but also in the future. We're like, oh, right. A machine guy could be in my future. He could be around the corner. Who knows, right? So that's why we get
Exactly.
into trouble.
Oh, for sure. Now, stress is not just a body issue. It also affects us on how people actually see themselves. So when people say, stay stressed long enough, they usually lose confidence. They become harder on themselves, and they start to feel like, they're failing. How are stress and self-esteem connected?
So you have to know what self-esteem is. Okay. So I read these articles and they talk about self-esteem should not be related to your achievements. Like, you shouldn't tie your self-esteem to your achievements. You should just love yourself for yourself.
Yes.
You're like, well, that's awesome advice. But if I'm 50 years old and I haven't figured that out, it ain't happening. You telling me to love myself is not going to make me love myself, right?
Right.
When I started pulling apart what actually makes up self-esteem, where do we come up with it when we're 1 year old to decide we have good or bad self-esteem? How does that happen? What's the process?
Right.
So to me, there's three parts to self-esteem. And the first part is answering the question, am I a good person?
Yes.
Okay. The second one is, am I doing things the right way? And the third one is, am I confident that if I have something to do in the future, I'll be good at it?
Right.
So I've met people who I said, somebody was on using heroin. I go, oh, your self-esteem sucks. He goes, no, it isn't. I think when I go out and play baseball, I think I'm going to be the best, right? Or I think I'm a really good guy. I'm like, oh, but do you think you're doing things the right way?
Yeah.
He goes, well, no, I don't think I should be on heroin and I should be off. I'm like, yeah, see, that's so there's three parts to self-esteem and you got to be
Right.
good on all three. But what I find is most people, no, I'm going to say this. Everybody would be positive self-esteem if they count right.
Yeah.
So when you look at, am I a good person? There's two factors to that. What have I achieved? And what kind of traits do I have? And what
Right.
I see is people don't count their achievements.
Yeah.
And here's why. They go, well, I should have done that. So if you play, I'm like, if I'm playing with a 5-year-old in basketball and I beat him, is that really an achievement? Do I really get self-esteem points for that? Right?
Right.
No, because I should beat a 5-year-old, right?
Yes.
So you don't give yourself any points. But what I say is, every achievement you have, you should get 10 points. So when I
Right.
get up in the morning, I'm alive. 10 points. I got food. 10 points. I got water. 10
Right.
points. I got a safe house. 10 points. I have indoor toilets, 10 points. I get 50 points just by opening my eyeballs, right?
Yeah.
How nice is that? So then if something doesn't go well and a prescription doesn't get written correctly and I have to redo it, 10 points minus, I'm still a plus 40. So I'm still feeling good about myself, right?
Right.
Second one is these good traits. And so what people tend to do is not pay attention to their good traits and put their bad traits in neon lights and shine them for everybody to see. So I
Yeah.
saw a person who was drinking too much alcohol and she's like, oh, that's horrible. And it's made me a bad mom. I'm like, wait, what do you mean a bad mom? I go, did you feed your kids? She's like, well, yeah. I go, well, did you take them to school? Yeah. Like, did they turn out okay? Well, yeah, kind of. Like, I could have been better if I wasn't. I go, all right, I'll give you that you could have been better, but you weren't bad.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. You were a good mom. You did what you're supposed to do as a mom, right?
Right.
And that alcohol, you stopped.
Yeah.
You got rid of that bad trait, right? So when you start keeping accurate score, there's nobody that's not going to have good self-esteem. And
Right.
then doing things the right way, that has to do with society, right?
Yes.
Because what's the right way has a lot of influence from what you think, but also what a society thinks. So when we
Yes.
were talking about mothers, they think they should be taking care of their kids. So when they're not, they're like, oh, I should be home with my kids more or whatever, right? And
Right.
so you just have to be figuring out what society's asking, because society's saying to you, no, but you need to make money too, because to pay for your house, to house your kids and get them to school, you got to make
Yes,
money, right? So
exactly.
there's going to be have to be a balance there. And then the
Oh,
last one
absolutely.
is this confidence. And some of that comes, and then you're right. Like if you have low self-esteem and you think you suck at everything, well, then you're going to go, well, I'm not going to be able to learn how to do that. That's crazy. Why would I even think I could learn how to do that, right?
Right.
So like when I was being an author, I was like 25% of me thought, I don't know, who are you kidding, right? And so I had to learn, no, I can be good at this. I just have to learn. I'd spend a lot of time learning how to be a good doctor. I can learn how to be a good author. And that
Right.
goes back to this mindset where there's a thing called fixed mindset versus growth mindset. The
Yes.
growth mindset says, I can learn a new skill.
Yes.
There's going to be some struggles. It's not going to go perfect. There's going to be some setbacks, but that doesn't keep me from learning and getting better. And if I
Right.
stick with it and don't see these as failures and they're just setbacks that I just need to learn, they're learning experiences. And then I'm going to get better and better and better and better. And the
Right.
statistics, this is an interesting statistic. People talk about, well, I don't want to change my job because then I'll be behind.
Yeah.
Here's the statistic. The average person has seven professions in their lifetime.
Right.
And it only takes them 2 years and they're up to where 90% of people would be in that job.
Yeah.
I'm like, mate, that's it. Yeah, right. 2 years and you're up with everybody else. So like that's, and that's what I've been finding. As an author, I would put myself up in the top 75% because a lot of
Yes.
authors are just sitting around writing their book in their den and like don't really want to do anything with it. So
Right.
I'm like, I've hired people, I've been on podcast, blah, blah, blah. I'm doing things to get that book out there,
Yeah.
which is more than most authors do, right?
Right.
So it didn't take that long, right? So.
I love it. Now let's make this practical for the person listening right now who feels stressed, overwhelmed, and mentally tired. What are the first three things that you would tell them to do?
Okay, here's the first thing that I tell everybody. Stop resigning yourself to being stressed out. That's it. You don't have to live the life stressed out. It is not the way it has to be.
Yes.
But it's not going to happen by itself. There are things you can do. You can read my book, Highway to Happy Place, Roadmap to Less Stress. Listen to your podcast. You have some great interviews on there, right? So there's lots of things they can do, but you have to do something. It's
Right.
not going to fix itself. So
Yes.
it doesn't take a lot. Changing your perceptions, changing, some ways your attitude, learning some new facts to put in your perspective prism,
Yeah.
like can change your stress dramatically, but you have to do something. So instead of sitting in your overwhelmed cave where you're dark and you can't get out and freaking out,
Yeah.
do something, read a book, watch a podcast, and change what you're doing in your behavior, and you will be better.
I love that. Now, what is the fastest mental shift that helps people feel less trapped?
Well, I would say that when people are overwhelmed, that's probably where they're feeling the worst. Okay. So what we talked about is people think of worry as something they're supposed to do because it
Yes.
equates with being caring. But being overwhelmed, people go, I shouldn't be overwhelmed. That's bad. I don't like that. I got to get out of this, right?
Yeah.
So what I show people is there's a thing I call the S curve, right? So the S curve is here's where you're at. and you got one or two stresses. But then a third stress comes along and the slope goes up like an S, and then it's at the top, and now you're overwhelmed. But then overwhelm becomes a fourth problem. So what I say to them is, this looks horrible. It looks bad. It's scary. You're overwhelmed. You're past your coping skills. Any little thing now becomes a big deal, right? Here's what I show them. Look, if I just get rid of one problem, you go back down the curve and you're back into control. That's it. So it's not as scary as you think, because all I got to do is get rid of one problem and you're in control. What? Yeah. So when they see that, then they go, oh, well, I can get rid of one problem, or I can reduce this, all the stress. So if I change your perception, how, like if I go, instead of everybody else's stress being a 10, now it's a 5, now I'll just lower the whole S curve down, right? So that is something that is simple, but it changes your attitude. Like, oh, this is fixable. I can do something about this. Because when they're overwhelmed, I think you said this earlier, they go, I don't even know where to get started. So they don't. They just sit there and go, I'll just sit here and stay in my bedroom and not come out. Well, that doesn't fix the problem, right? But when I show you, look, all you got to do is get rid of one or lower the intensity of all of them. Well, that's something they can do.
And what should people stop doing immediately if they want less stress?
Well, I would. So what I find is that probably one of the biggest things that gets people into that overwhelmed state is worrying about stuff that hasn't happened. They can feel less worry. That would make an immediate change. So stop equating worry with caring, right? And really what you're trying to do is solve a problem or plan for a problem. And you can do that with a worry organizer and do it without fear. So if you can plan, but without the fear, then that will change your life dramatically. And the second would be to use that empathy wall, where you are giving advice. So you're caring at a 5, but not as a 10. And you've now changed the metric of your success from that person gets better to, hey, I gave them really good advice and I gave it to them in a way they could hear it. It's on them to get better.
Now, if someone's listening, then they have, they had started to believe stress is just who they are now. What do you want to tell them? What do you want them to know?
Well, again, we're always going to have stress. It's not going to go away as long as we're alive. So really what you need to do is learn how to manage your stress effectively and efficiently. And to do that, to know where it's coming from, and to know where it's coming from, you have to, I think my ideas make the most sense, because I've listened to some other podcasts and the person goes, if you want to be less stressed, you have to be your authentic self. And you're like, what the hell does that mean? I don't even know what that means, right? Like, you just have to love and you be spirit. I'm like, what? That doesn't help me. That's not grounded, right? But what I say to people is, look, these are the things, these are the ingredients that you as a human have. So like literally every human in the world worries. Now, what I worry about is different than what a person in China worries about, or what I worry about is different than what a 20-year-old worries about, or what I worry about is different than what a black person worries about. But we all worry. We all feel guilt. We all have regret. We all get bored sometimes. We all have some self-esteem issues. We all get overwhelmed occasionally, right? Let's do that. That's something that are the ingredients to what makes things so stressful. And so when you realize that those are just side effects to our skills, now you can start developing tools that are not just generic tools. Like I can tell you meditate or exercise. Great. That does. That works. Not that they don't work, but they're generic. When I say to you a worry organizer and a realistic optimist, or I say shoeboxes and an empathy wall, these are very specific skills to treat that very specific problem, which will make it more effective.
Now, if you could leave people with one message about stress and finding their happy place, what would it be?
Read my book.
I love that.
Yeah, no, because I will say, here's what I'll say to you, right? Like, as a doctor, people think of my life as like, oh, you were a doctor, you had money, your life was less stress. Like, no, you don't understand, right? Literally, every time I see a patient, it's a $1 million life and death decision. Because if I give you the wrong antibiotic and you have a reaction and you die, you're going to die and I'm going to get sued. That's a $1 million life and death decision. It doesn't matter what decision I'm making. So when you pay attention to that, like, it can paralyze you, right? And that's including, because I've been sued for malpractice. I've had the board, my physician's medical board, come down and tell me I'm doing things wrong, blah, blah, blah. So I've been under this gun before. I've been through divorce. I've had my kids that have this problem and that problem, right? So I've had plenty of stresses in my life. And doing the things that I wrote in my book have made it so not, here's the key. Not only did I survive it, I actually did better because of it. Like my board, I was taking care of chronic pain patients. And when I started 40 years ago, they were like, you're undertreating these patients. They need more medicine to get their pain under control. So I did that. So people were going, hey, thanks, Dr. Sprouse. You're helping my pain. Thank you very much. But then the pendulum switched it. And they go, oh, you doctors, you're just prescribing opioids and you're making everybody an opioid addict. So now we're going to get you in trouble for the same things you were doing that we were patting you on the back before. So I could have saw that as horrible. And I've had plenty of my colleagues that when they got into that kind of pressure, they quit. They said, I'm out of here. Well, I'm like, well, you can't help anybody as a doctor if you quit. What the good does that do? So not only did I not quit, but I said to my wife, look, my board could end up doing stupid things. Like they could take my license away. They have that power and not for a good reason, but whatever. So I said, well, we got to deal with the situation we have. And there's this term called a creator versus a victim. So I could have seen myself as the victim. Oh, woe is me, the victim. But I saw myself as the creator, which meant that I said, okay, I got this challenge. I got this obstacle. What am I going to do to get around it or through it, whatever? And so my wife and I made the decision, all right, we're going to work our butts off and make as much money as we can while we can, so that then that will lessen the sting if the board did the worst and took my license away. So we made decisions. She became my billing person, even though she didn't like it. I started traveling to nursing homes that were an hour and a half away because they needed a doctor. And so we were able to make a fair amount of money so that we then could say, do your worst, board, because I got enough money. But you also said, well, look, if I can't be a doctor, what? That's going to mess up my identity. So then I started, we took a class on how to be real estate investors. So that became a place where we could have identity, but it's also a place of income source, right? And I became an author. I'm like, oh, well, that gives me a different identity and that gives me a different income source. So, and the third thing was, since my board was telling me I was doing things wrong, I was like, wait a second. So then that made me go back and read more. It made me go back and study more and find more information, find better ways to treat pain. It made me examine, am I doing things the right way? Are my ethics in the right place? So it made me a better doctor and it made me better able to handle adversity because of the decisions I made. So in the end, now I look back and go, I didn't like the process, but I'm like, thank you, board. You made me a better doctor and you made me do things that made me more comfortable and able to retire when I could still walk around, right?
Oh, 100%. Now tell everybody about your book. Tell them what it's called, tell them what it's about. Give us a little synopsis and a little bit of the
So this
message
book is
behind
called
it.
Highway to Your Happy Place, a Roadmap to Less Stress. And in that book, I describe your happy place. And then I describe six of the stresses that I think are significant. So I talk about worry and guilt and regret and boredom, low self-esteem, and feeling overwhelmed. But in my head, there's at least five other books that are going to be called Highway to Your Happy Place, Mile Marker 2, and Mile Marker 3, and Mile Marker 4. And they're going to have other stresses. So other things are like grief, suicide, communication problems, marital difficulties. Right, all these different things. How do you deal with physical problems? So I have it all mapped out that there's going to be at least four or five other books, and then maybe I'll go, okay, let's do Highway to Your Happy Place for teenagers, or for old people, or for right. And then there's another book that I'm going to be writing, or I'm in the process of writing now, called Loop Breakers, where we talk about the how to get out of a stress reducer loop, right? So that's coming out. And then I have a website. So if people have some more questions, they can go on the website and the chapter on worry is right there. They can download it and it's free, right? So if they go to the website, it's thelessstressdoc.com. They can go on there and I'll show you some of the podcasts that I've done in the past and some papers that I've written. And it will have your podcast on there. And but it has the organized the worry chapter that you can just download. And then it also has a link to a course that I've done. That's broken down into like little 15-minute segments. And it kind of goes through the book, but like there's a unit and there's four sections in there. They're each about 15 minutes. And so then if you're riding in your car You can just download it and listen to it, and you could get the same information, but then instead of reading. And there isn't it. So if you want to get the book, it's on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, and it's in paperback and hardback, but it's also an ebook. And I also did an audiobook. So a lot of people,
Oh,
that's been the
wow.
new business where people do audio
Yeah.
because they're riding in their car commuting and they're
Yeah.
listening to a book, right? So that's, and I did it in my own voice. My
Yeah.
wife and I had gone to this show. It was a Shakespearean show, and it was King Lear. Okay. And the guy who played King Lear had this magnificent, wonderful voice. I'm like, oh, I want to get that guy to read my book for me, right? What
Yeah.
I learned was, no, people want to hear me. They
Yes.
want to see who, they want to know who you are. And because I'm going to read the book, because I know how to do the inflections of what's important and what's not, like that
Yeah.
guy's just going to be reading the book. So I ended up doing it myself. So.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. I want the listeners to know that what I appreciate about this conversation is that it makes stress feel more manageable,
Yes.
not because life becomes perfect, but because people can start understanding the loops, habits, and mental patterns that keep stress alive and actually do something good about them. I think, Dr. Sprouse, you bring a message that a lot of people need right now in their life. Stress may be common, but it does not have to run our lives. And that's what I love about what you're doing. And I thank you so much for being on the show. And for everybody that doesn't know, Dr. Sprouse he is going to be part of our podcast community, and he's going to have his own podcast, and you'll be seeing it soon. And I am so excited that you're joining our podcast community, because you're going to be sharing a lot of information about how to improve our lives and how to overcome a lot of these issues that people just get stuck on: the overwhelm, the grief, the stress, all these things that we don't have to dwell on. Because there's so many times people wake up in the morning and they're literally having a panic attack, because
Yes, absolutely.
they subconsciously, while they're sleeping, all these things are just wrapping around their head in a spiral. And for those people who just like wake up early because they're just so stressed out and they just don't know what to do, if you give them one more tip before we leave, and anything that comes to mind, maybe one takeaway or two takeaways, what would you like to tell people, just so maybe give them some comfort, before we end this show?
Well, I think you already said it. Like, we don't have to be the victim of our stress. We can be the creator, and we can figure out how to manage it so that we can live our lives and be in that happy place. You said, you encapsulated, that's the key, right? No, I've worked with patients who couldn't control their emotions. And the reason they couldn't control them, because they didn't think they were supposed to, or they didn't think they had the skill to. And I'm like, when you realize that stress is out there and you just have to learn how to manage it, and then if you have tools to do it and you go, oh, I can do this, yeah, that is the message. Like, you have the skill. Like, one of my teachers told me this. He goes, everyone is getting a certain outcome. They might not like the outcome, but they can change their input to get a different outcome. And they have all the tools they need inside of them right now to get that better outcome. My book just helps give them some insight into the tools they already have themselves. When you have all the tools you need, you just need to use them.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Dr. Gary, for being on the show today. And I look forward to having you back soon. And thank you. Just thank you for everything and what you're doing. You're a blessing.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. I like it, right? This is great. Hopefully, we have one person out there today. So.
I think we're definitely going to help one person out there. With all the information we provided, we are definitely going to help one person out there. I love it. I love it. Thank you so much. I can't wait to talk to you soon.
All right, bye.